for our audience of blind and print-impaired folks, your North Carolina Reading Service presents... The Indie Week. This issue, dated July 28th, 2021, is read by John Federson. Our theme music has been performed by a wide variety of musicians over the past few months, and this week is no different. Today we present from Ferguson's Big and Tall Menswear Emporium, the duo of Frank. Wonderful. And we were glad to squeeze him into our music rotation today. And we'll drop right into our columns. The first is from Sarah Pequeño from Orange County, Once in a Lifetime. The Orange County Board of Commissioners has had only three vacancy appointments since the 1950s. Come September, the new total will be four. Jerry Cohen has been in local politics for decades. He currently serves on the Wake County Board of Elections. Before that, he was a special counsel for the North Carolina General Assembly. Before that, he served on the Chapel Hill Town Council, one of only three UNC Chapel Hill students to be elected to a seat in recent history. He has kept up with Orange County despite no longer living there and is a treasure trove of information for writers and the greater community. So it comes as no surprise that Cohen was considered for an empty seat on the Orange County Board of Commissioners in 1973 as a UNC Chapel Hill law student. Cohen describes members of the Democratic Party going through a nomination process to create a slate. Seven people were nominated by others. Cohen says of the process, four candidates got a majority and three did not, so those four names went on to the county commissioners. I was one of the four. I finished second place. In fact, I nominated somebody else who finished first, and then somebody else nominated me. This month, a new appointment process began for the Orange County Board of Commissioners to fill the seat of Mark DeRosen, who was only a few months into a four-year term when he accepted a job at Florida A&M University Law School. It is only the fourth time in the last 70 years that a vacancy has opened on the board. The last one was in the 1980s. Almost 50 years after the iteration Cohen remembers, the appointment process looks a little different. The applicants still have to be Democrats, but they aren't nominated by other people and have yet to be approved by county Dems. Instead, the four women who applied submitted candidate questionnaires online, leaving the commissioners and their constituents more to consider before the September 2nd hearing, where the commissioners could vote on DeRosen's replacement. Marilyn Carter, Ronnie Dossey, Penny Rich, and Anna Richards have a range of experience, from serving as president of the Chapel Hill Carborough NAACP to being former elected officeholders. Rich was a county commissioner for 8 years before losing the Democratic primary in June 2020 by 7 votes to DeRosen, another incumbent. Rich hopes this will be considered in the appointment process. She says Cameron Indoor Stadium only fits 9,300 people. That means 3,200 people that voted for me would be standing outside. I mean, if you put that in perspective, it's a ton of people. It's a lot of people to shut down their vote. While not a former commissioner, Dossey has served on the Chapel Hill Carborough City Schools Board of Education since 2015. She prioritizes community health by seeing that people's basic needs are met. Quote, I have focused on education as a pathway to community health, and as I have gotten deeper into that work, it has become more apparent that so many factors outside of schools influence overall community wellness and what happens in schools. County government has the scale and resources to provide structural supports which more broadly contribute to community health. Carter and Richards also come from political backgrounds. Carter recently served as the chair of the Orange County Democratic Party, and Richards is the former president of the Chapel Hill Carborough NAACP. Richards says the commissioner's role as a safety net for the community is what called her to apply in the first place. Quote, I thought maybe this is an opportunity for me to take the perspective that I have of having been a community organizer and an advocate to that board. It was a hard decision, but I decided that I would apply and we'll see what happens. There will be time allotted for the applicants to answer questions about their applications on September 2. It's likely the board will cast their votes that night, but the results could lead to even more waiting. Cohen's appointment process had a strange outcome. At the time, he says, there was a split among the four commissioners. While they were all Democrats, two were more conservative and two more liberal. The vote came to a stalemate, stayed there for 60 days, and was decided by the clerk of Superior Court. The clerk chose Melvin Whitfield, a dairy farmer from White Cross, whose name was not introduced by the county Democrats. There's a possibility that this happens to the commissioners this year. If the six remaining members can't choose a finalist, it could once again end up in the hands of the clerk of Superior Court. Mark Kleinschmidt, who currently holds that job, previously served as mayor of Chapel Hill. Rich says she feels that Kleinschmidt's integrity would keep him from appointing someone who hasn't gone through the formal application process, but he could still make that decision. Technically, the county could, too. Whitfield was up for re-election months after his appointment and lost in the primary to Jan Pinney, the man who received the most votes in the Democrat Party nominating process. Similarly, the 2021 appointee would serve until only 2022, when the public will decide, through a special election, who will serve out the remainder of the term. It could be worse. Four vacancies since the 1950s is remarkable. And Cohen finishes saying, that's pretty low, all in all. I guess they elect healthy people. Carol Espinoza-Jane brings us news from Raleigh, and it's this column titled Downtown Recovery. Raleigh will use federal funds for an ice rink and other improvements downtown, as well as a grant pool for local businesses. The federal government is set to begin funding various renovations in Raleigh to combat the economic losses brought by the COVID-19 pandemic. Early this month, the Raleigh City Council unanimously approved a resolution to accept approximately $73.2 million in direct funding from the U.S. Department of Treasury, marking the beginning of many renovations and economic aid coming to the city's future. Mary Vig, V-I-G-U-E, director at Raleigh Budget and Management Services, said at a July 6th council meeting, the American Rescue Plan clearly outlines a need to utilize funds to assist vulnerable populations, to address the health and economic impacts, including housing, homelessness, mental health, and food security. The Biden administration passed the American Rescue Plan and Economic Relief Plan back in March. The act, famously known for the stimulus checks it delivered to many Americans earlier this year, has given Raleigh and various cities financial aid to combat the economic losses of the pandemic. The city of Raleigh plans to phase its usage of the funds in order to pay for different needs at different times. Vig said, when we previously presented the plan, we proposed a multi-phase approach to allocating these funds. The initial phase will identify immediate needs to get funds into the community to address health impacts, negative economic impacts, and to assist the hospitality industry. From the approved $73.2 million, $2.3 million will likely be used this fall. From that first wave of funding, $400,000 will be allocated for light and sound improvements in downtown Raleigh, to mitigate COVID-19 transmission by promoting more outdoor space usage. An additional $200,000 will be allocated to fund a grant pool where local businesses impacted by COVID can apply for financial aid. And another $250,000 will be used to fund the creation of an ice rink in downtown Raleigh. Vig said in an email to the Indy that decision to fund an ice rink came from a study from the city's Economic Development and Innovation Committee, which looked at ways to improve economic growth in the downtown area. Vig said the prior ice rink drew visitors to the downtown during the fall and winter months. This outdoor activation will support small businesses and restaurants negatively impacted from the pandemic. approximately $230,000 will also be used to fund a downtown economic development study in collaboration with the Downtown Raleigh Alliance. According to Vig, the study will look at more ways that downtown Raleigh can improve retail strategies and other economic opportunities for the city to grow. The study will focus on finding ways to increase diversity and equity initiatives within downtown Raleigh. An external consultant selected by the city and the Downtown Raleigh Alliance will complete the study, according to Vig. Vig and Councilmember Nicole Stewart emphasized during this July 6th council meeting that, as the first wave of funds are targeted to quickly address some of the more critically hit areas in Raleigh, it means that a lot of the initial funds will go towards downtown areas. But downtown Raleigh will not be the only area to receive funding. Stewart said, "I want to recognize that downtown was hit the hardest during last year's protests, but also COVID, and so we're still feeling that impact. My understanding was that this was an opportunity to quickly respond to that initially, but also be able to have funds to help businesses outside of downtown moving forward, and I just want to get that on the record and make sure I have that right." To help manage these new initiatives, approximately $230,000 will be used to create two new temporary senior fiscal analyst positions to manage these federal grant compliance reports over approximately 5 years. A few council members expressed concerns over these grant-funded jobs, however, stating that the city's budget would have to take on new employees, such as social workers. Councilmember Corey Branch said, "If they have one social worker that can only do 40 hours, but this person has helped people find housing and receive assistance and services, I would really employ whatever we can do to push that social worker part. Then we can figure out the funding. We have time, but the need is now." Despite some pushback, the Raleigh City Council unanimously approved this resolution. Vig will present the next update for the American Rescue Plan Act's fund redistribution in a future work session. Vig told the Indy that the funding overseers would update the City Council on each project shortly. The city has until December of 2024 to commit the funds, Vig said, and its phased approach is guided on advice of the United States Treasury. A further update is expected to come to the Council in August or September. Tomasi McDonald now checks in from Durham. Building bridges. Just after 6 p.m. last week on an evening threatening rain and thunder, I met a group of women at the Whole Foods on Broad Street. For the past 3 years, these women and several more have comprised a Durham-based multiracial group from different cultures and classes that gathers each month to discuss, learn, and heal around the issues of race, class, and gender. Today they are working with women and others all over the country to help create a less racist society, and they are hoping their work will serve as a national model. Women Dismantling Racism operates as a subgroup of Our Sacred Circles and privately owned Joyous Shout, funded by Rena Rachel Galper, that, quote, works at the intersection of justice, healing, spirituality, and creativity, according to the Our Sacred Circles website. Galper, who is white, says WDR first came together in May of 2018 when a bunch of women from different races and backgrounds met at the L Room, a women's retreat center in North Durham. Galper told the Indy, "We wanted to understand why the relationship with women of color and the white community was so broken. How do we repair that relationship?" Galper says those initial meetings included forming a leadership group and getting educated, but also exploring how to go about healing the broken relationship between women of color and white women. Another member, Kay, this is the letter K, who declined to give her full name due to the nature of her work, says it's incumbent upon white women to educate themselves about systemic racism, not to be fragile in their interactions with people of color and to build relationships with people of color outside of work or meetings. Kay says, there was definitely a lack of trust at first. A lot of white women don't see their microaggressions toward black women. Being anti-racist is a daily practice outside of meetings and book study groups. It's a mental and emotional practice to do every day. Our Sacred Circles has a wisdom council whose members provide support to women and others who are doing racial justice and healing work. The Wisdom Council has an intentionality and immediacy about the need to address historic wrongs. Part of the ongoing work includes healing rituals. During a recent gathering, the white women in attendance apologized on behalf of their ancestors to the black women, who accepted the apologies on behalf of their ancestors. Kay says, we are not passing the torch. This is a place where we are trying to hold this torch together. That was easy enough, Galper says, about the growing understanding that's taking place inside the meetings. She says, it was the action part when the women failed. They were doing really good at reading books. White women have failed miserably on many occasions. Kay adds, they have failed to put the anti-racist work into action. In response to the pandemic and in order to reach more justice workers and healers across the country and even globally, our Sacred Circles is now completely virtual. An upshot was that the number of attendees increased, says Donna Frederick, who formerly owned and operated the Playhouse, a toy store on 9th Street, for decades. The pandemic, especially during the shutdown, left everyone in the same boat, with their lives turned topsy-turvy without job security, ways of meeting, and not having that next paycheck. Galper says the pandemic has accentuated the worst elements of American society, particularly the actions of white supremacists. It was also during the pandemic that the group's members, like everyone else in America and around the world, witnessed the murder of George Floyd. Frederick says Floyd's death marked a turning point for the group and helped to galvanize their understanding of systemic racism, where white boys are, for the most part, assured of coming home to their mothers after an encounter with the police. Black sons and their mothers have no such guarantees. She says the group has been talking about racism, but to witness a white officer kneeling on the neck of a dying black man begging for his life was an epiphany. Frederick says, you can talk about something, but then when you actually see it, it's different. With all of the demonstrations last summer and all the things we were talking about were coming to a head. It was recognized before, but with Floyd's death and the protest, it was like, oh, now we really see it. That's the difference. The racism that fueled the genocide of this country's indigenous people and enslavement of kidnapped Africans to make white men wealthy is called this country's original sin. That said, the anti-racist group members know that dismantling systemic racism in America is well nigh impossible. The WDR members say they see setbacks in voter restrictions, state-sanctioned attempts to whitewash history, and the ridicule faced by supporters of reparations to black Americans whose ancestors labored under the lash to build this country. Galper says discussions about reparations are, quote, a constant in her consulting and classes. She says, we've talked about equity being on a continuum toward the goal of reparations. Reparations critics talk about slavery as if it were ancient history, but I grew up with a grandmother and uncle whose parents were born into slavery. Moreover, as a TikTok user pointed out recently, Thomas Jefferson was still alive when Harriet Tubman was born, and Ronald Reagan was alive when she died. Galper says, I don't know if white people are willing and able to make changes, but we have to keep doing this work, because right now, this is the best game in town. This is the most important struggle of our time. Frederick says, in reference to critical race theory, CRT, it's fear. It's all about fearing the truth will come out. How can you build if you're suppressing the truth and thinking you can work around it? Galper says, white folks are scared of being held accountable. Everything we have, we've stolen. The fact that many white folks feel that they have worked hard to get what they have sometimes obscures the fact that we have stolen from so many and deprived them of the opportunity of a good life that we all deserve. A similar fear drives the voter suppression measures proposed or passed in state houses across the country. Far from preventing voter fraud that doesn't exist, the waves of legislation show a willingness on the part of whites to criminalize black people's access to the ballot. The black vote can no longer matter if it causes white discomfort. Kay calls it white fragility. Galper says, white fragility is actually white sabotage. White people are afraid of losing power. Frederick says the disenfranchisement of black voters drives her work to get people to realize the political power that voters actually have. She says, sometimes we just take for granted that coming together has no power. You know, that our voices are not heard. We've seen that in a bunch of people coming together saying, no, this is not right, but also attacking the system that makes it not right. Learning that the system is not right is powerful. Kay says, one thing that makes this group unique is that we're building personal relationships. For women, we do not, or I should say, I do not trust a lot of white people, period. But I have gained trust through building relationships. Kay added that she's part of another anti-racism group in the Triangle where, quote, we, the parents, have built relationship. She goes on, so now we know what my son goes through when he goes to school and what my daughter was going through. Because those relationships were built, they can put a face on the child going through these issues. Galper says white people should exercise more humility and openness, and white people should use their privilege to actively work to dismantle systemically racist systems. She says white people have to be willing to give up power or share power. That's the hardest part, even within myself. She tells the story of a child she met at a queer culture camp where she was working recently. Quote, I told her, I have these two parts of myself. One of me wants to mobilize and connect with other progressive. The other part of me wants to ship all the white supremacists off to an island with no boat. And the child said, perhaps you need to build a bridge to those warring parts of yourself. Isn't that awesome? She's 15 years old. That gives me hope. To Rebecca Schneid now, news from Durham. Durham's public playgrounds still need work to provide spaces and structures for children with disabilities. At the 53 playgrounds in Durham, most children can enjoy all the structures available, including slides, swings, and seesaws galore. For Victoria Facelli and her daughter Elizabeth, not her real name, this is not the case. Elizabeth has cerebral palsy, and Facelli continuously reckons with how her daughter is excluded from the community in ways that she did not anticipate. As Elizabeth enters her childhood years, this exclusion is very noticeable on playgrounds. Facelli says, it's really limiting, and that really sends a message to my kiddo about whether or not she's welcome and whether or not Durham is proud that she lives here. While all new or renovated playgrounds must adhere to the Americans with Disabilities Act, that's ADA guidelines, these requirements are outdated at 30 years old. An ADA-compliant playground must have an accessible entrance and transfer stations, that's spaces where a child in a wheelchair can pull themselves onto a play structure. But even with those features, many kids will still find themselves relegated to certain parts of the playground, unable to enjoy most of the play features. Furthermore, while each playground has to have one structure that is accessible for children with disabilities, that could be something as small as a tic-tac-toe board. And if an entire playground is surrounded by mulch, it makes the entire structure hard to maneuver for someone in a wheelchair. Of all the playgrounds in Durham, only one listed on the city's parks and recreation websites has an accessible swing. That's Drew Granby Park. Ficelli and her daughter often go to accessible parks in Raleigh, such as Sassafras, all children's playground at Laurel Hills. But when it was closed for months during the pandemic, the two couldn't even go there. She says that's the problem with having those tokenized spots of inclusivity. When they're closed, we're stuck. Why does this happen? For one, says Betsy McMichael, the executive director of First in Families of North Carolina, it's a cycle of inaccessibility. That group is a nonprofit dedicated to helping people with disabilities and their families be engaged in their communities. When a space is inaccessible for children with disabilities, their families don't access those spaces, and these children are not seen. Able-bodied families in the spaces then tend to forget disabled children exist. So then, when largely able-bodied planners are creating new parks, they often don't keep accessibility in mind, and the cycle continues. McMichael says, in these small neighborhoods where there's an accessible swing, sometimes the parent will take it down with the excuse that it's a big swing that takes up space and, quote, no one uses that one anyway. It takes a while for this to become the norm. Additionally, Durham's playgrounds are not large regional spaces. Many of them are small neighborhood parks. And while the number of them means they're accessible geographically, it also means they are rather basic play structures. Durham's park department sends out an evaluation survey periodically to Durhamites, asking them what kinds of play structures have been working, which have not, and what they want to see in playgrounds, and more. Ficelli says she applauds this effort, but asks, what about the minority, left out in a system that rewards the majority? Earlier this year, Ficelli emailed the Durham City Council and Parks Department, telling her and Elizabeth's story and asking that the city celebrate Disability Pride Month in July by tending to the needs of the children with disabilities within the city. She asks, as we are needing to tear down unsafe structures like what is happening at Rockwood in South Durham, where the youth structures are being renovated, and replace them, can we replace them with accessible structures? We need to restructure the way our playgrounds are so as not to segregate disabled kids from non-disabled. Ficelli acknowledges that in many of the accessible playgrounds she's visited, features are beneficial for all kinds of children. But at the rare playgrounds built for children with disabilities, the structures are often overrun with non-disabled kids. Ficelli says it's because those playgrounds are cool. Kids love an accessible zip line and an accessible swing. It becomes a problem of having to educate these kids to keep them open for children with disabilities. Wade Walcott, the director of Durham Parks and Rec, is relatively new to the role. He moved to Durham and assumed the job in October of last year. Ficelli says Walcott and the city council have been receptive to her ideas on how to make more accessible spaces in Durham. And Walcott says, it was great to hear from her. It started the conversation of not just with Rockwood and other parks we're renovating, but what can we do to make sure we're all on the same page and have accessibility and inclusion at the top of the mind in the future. Specifically, with the new playground under construction at the Wheels Family Fun Park, which the city bought last year, the city is looking to adopt accessible concepts. Ficelli says she hopes that other people with different disabilities will speak up to the Parks Department about what they need. She says, I had the experience of hearing from someone that an accessible playground was accessible in some ways, but their kid had a visual impairment, and the color of the steps in the playground was so similar to the ground, they couldn't see them. That's something I would never have thought about because that's not my experience with my child. Wallace says he will continue to work with Ficelli in order to figure out more tangible ways to design spaces for kids with disabilities, like Elizabeth. The goal, he says, is to eventually adopt basic standard operating procedures for every single renovation and building project the department works on, and to look at them through social equity lens. Recent discussions estimate that these basic guidelines will be ready to celebrate Disability Pride Month 2022. Wallace says he's proud of the geographic diversity in playground improvement and is quick to discuss the extensive list of renovations in playgrounds throughout the past 10 years. Further, he points to new projects, including the highly inclusive Hoover Road Playground in East Durham. But he concedes there's work to be done and says, "We also want to establish a strong connection with other inclusive groups of people with different abilities so they become asset groups for us when we're thinking about park design." McMichael says this kind of proactive initiative taking is needed and is adamant that it should not be on those affected by the cycle of inaccessibility to advocate for the necessary changes. In order to break the cycle, she says, those in power must step up and finally begin implementing ADA requirements as a bare minimum and more robust accessibility standards. As McMichael talks about her previous experiences, both in professional life and as the mother of a now 29-year-old with disabilities, it's evident in her voice that she's tired. She says, "We shouldn't have to work so hard. The people who need it shouldn't have to be advocating to make us all get it right. Ultimately, it's the will of the leaders and the city of Durham who have the funds for the park to say, look, discussion time is over. It's time to make the damn parks accessible." All right, general North Carolina news about the prison system, public safety, by Arabella Saunders, and the byline credits and contribution from Hannah Critchfield. Failure to report. On November 14th of last year, Robert McIntyre, a 70-year-old man incarcerated in Central Prison, was admitted to the UNC Rex medical facility in Raleigh for pneumonia, COPD complications, and a non-ST elevation myocardial infarction, a type of heart attack. He received medical care and tested negative for COVID-19. Then he was sent back to Central Prison. Less than a month later, McIntyre returned to Rex from the evening of December 13th, suffering from shortness of breath. His oxygen levels fluctuated between 85 and 89%, and his heart was abnormally high at 150 beats per minute. At 11:51, McIntyre was pronounced dead. The death certificate issued clearly states COVID as a contributing cause of death, but the North Carolina Department of Public Safety, DPS, has never included Robert McIntyre in its official COVID death count, making McIntyre at least the seventh incarcerated person in North Carolina whose death the state has failed to report, either entirely or in a timely fashion. After a February 2021 investigation by North Carolina Health News and Vice News found the North Carolina DPS was misleading the public about the numbers of COVID-19 deaths of incarcerated people, the state promised to do better by changing its policies to ensure accurate COVID death counts. Before, the state agency received death certificates but chose to ignore them. DPS, which is tasked in part with oversight of state prison, has exclusively used its own medical reports without cross-referencing external documents, including those produced by external state-contracted medical examiners. That didn't work and led to information presented to the public via the DPS website that, in some cases, starkly conflicted with the reality understood by family members of the deceased. At the time, the state's chief medical officer for the prison system, Les Campbell, told Vice and NC Health News there was no reason for DPS to try to hide or conceal the reason for an inmate's death. DPS went on to publicly adjust its count in March, updating it to include Billy Bingham, 61, and Daryl Washington, 51, two men in DPS custody whose COVID-related deaths were uncovered in this North Carolina Health News and Vice report. The agency said it would start checking its own numbers alongside official death certificates. Yet a third person in DPS custody, whose death certificate named COVID as a cause of death, Luther Wilson, still hasn't been added to the count. The agency has also known about and excluded the death of Wilson, who was 60, due to renal failure and COVID-19 complications, for at least 5 months. Death certificates for three more incarcerated individuals who died in custody, McIntyre, Thurman Mosley, and Oliver Johnson, all have COVID-19 named as a primary or related cause of death, but none of the men are included in the count. DPS has known about Mosley and Oliver's exclusion from this count tally for months. Mosley's brother, James, says, "It angers me, but what I need to do now is research and challenge the state of North Carolina to make them include him in this." Billy Bingham's brother, Jay Bingham, says he feels like there's been no closure surrounding his brother's death. He says, "I have sat back and waited. August 3rd is coming up, and it's going to be a year. And I've not heard any feedback from DPS. I've not heard any follow-ups or any kind of condolences on the whole situation, on what's happening or what's going on or what's going to change to make it better. I've not seen that." In addition to the failure to report at least 7 COVID deaths since the pandemic began, DPS reporting is laden with mistakes. Even when its officials were informed about the errors, the agency took months to correct false information posted to its own website. On March 29th, DPS Communications Officer John Bull was made aware of a mistake in a bungled reporting of the death of David Scudder, 73, who was incarcerated at Hyde Correctional Institute at his time of death on January 16th of this year. Scudder's death was counted twice. On March 19th, DPS posted a correction online to include a, quote, "previously unreported January death," bringing its total from 52 to 53. On June 9th, a second correction was finally issued, explaining that Scudder was mistakenly counted twice, meaning that the agency's only March correction was an error. Also on June 9th, DPS added a previously unreported death to its list, Alexander Correctional Facility resident Jerry Combs, 55, who passed away in November. In keeping with its policy, DPS did not release his name. Instead, the agency simply referred to Combs as, quote, "a male in his mid-50s. That death certificate lists cardiovascular disease, not COVID-19, as his cause of death, as does a medical investigation conducted after his death. The medical investigation also states that following Combs' death, the North Carolina Baptist Hospital advised DPS to request the performance of an external examination and COVID test. The June 9th correction states that a positive test result was received 3 days after Combs' death. Lucy Combs, Jerry's mother, said DPS never informed her that her son could have possibly died from COVID-19. She said she got home from church on Sunday, November 15th, and shortly after, an Alexander Correctional Institute employee called her and told her that Jerry had died. Lucy communicated with the prison system one more time to request medical records and then never heard from the agency again. She says, "After he passed, I called Raleigh Central Prison to get medical records, and about 2 weeks later they called and told me I had to send a death certificate, which I did. They sent me a box of medical records of 2,700 pages, and then they charged me $50 for the papers." The last letter Jerry sent to his mother was dated November 3rd, 2020. Lucy says, "I see at the top when I open the letters, he had put out the top big letters. Listen, put on your gloves before reading. I've been a little sick, and they tested me for COVID. I don't think it is. I'll find out soon. Stay safe." When asked about the June 9th correction detailing Combs' death, Bull, DPS spokesman, said in a statement that when the agency concludes an incarcerated person's death was due to COVID-19, the website is updated, quote, in the interest of transparency. We're not going to address anything about a particular offender, Bull said in that statement. State law prohibits us from discussing an offender's medical condition, including his or her cause of death. DPS's repeated failures in accurately reporting COVID deaths within its facilities point to a level of bureaucratic incompetence, says Aaron Littman, deputy director of the UCLA Law COVID Behind Bars Data Project. And he says, it's a major state agency with a very large budget that should have no problem sharing accurate information in a timely fashion. The fact that it isn't doing that is, I think, reflective of a choice to be opaque. Bull said in a statement that the agency has nothing to gain by not reporting an incarcerated person's COVID-19 death. For family members of incarcerated people, the lack of accurate information surrounding COVID-19 deaths in DPS custody has lasting impacts. Bingham said, quote, I've had three dreams, and this is crazy, where my brother told me in the dreams that he died unjust, that he was a person too, and he was in prison, but he was a person that deserved proper care, and he deserved medical attention, and he didn't deserve to lay back there, and he couldn't even breathe. He doesn't deserve that. Nobody does, no matter what the situation is. Alrighty, let's go to food and drink. And this is a review of Dingo Dog Brewing Company there on Greensboro Street North in Carrboro. Hair of the Dog, it's called. The modern craft beer landscape is documented by hype. In such a packed, competitive industry, it's hard to carve out space for oneself. Up-and-coming breweries often chase the latest trends, capitalizing on the fickle desires of craft beer enthusiasts. More than likely, you've noticed the steady rise of hazy IPAs, heavily fruited sours, dessert stouts, and more recently, hard seltzers. There's even been a trendy offshoot of the hard seltzer craze with smoothie hard seltzers. For a brewery just starting out, it might feel like you're constantly playing catch-up with whatever happens to be in vogue that season. At the end of the day, though, this is only one model, writes John Paradiso. There are plenty of breweries that have found success forging their own path, and critically, finding their own definition of success. In Carrboro, that's exactly what Dingo Dog Brewing Company has done. They just opened their tap room, 410 North Greensboro Street, and they launched in 2015 as a genuine farmhouse brewery situated on Plow Girl Farm on a dirt road. Just outside of Carrboro, the Dingo Dog Brewery began extremely limited production in an old horse stable. The idea of a modern craft brewery might conjure thoughts of gleaming stainless steel tanks, reclaimed wood bars, and wide open floor plans. Dingo Dog is not so glamorous. Founder Tim Schwartzauer and head brewer Billy Gagon operate on a vintage brewing system that's just a step up from home brewing. They've retrofitted the barn to their needs, but the setup is still simple, and it works for them. Before launching Dingo Dog, Schwartzauer and Gagon were avid home brewers themselves, but unlike wide-eyed enthusiasts who say in unison, we should open a brewery over a pint of beer, Schwartzauer saw launching a brewery as an answer to a question he had been asking himself lately. Why can't a brewery or any kind of business generate revenue for a non-profit? In 2005, Schwartzauer, who grew up just outside of Jackson, Mississippi, witnessed the destructive aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. Schwartzauer, his mother, and stepfather assisted in volunteer efforts to rescue stray and abandoned animals, relocating them to temporary shelters and sanctuaries. Later that year, his family founded the Animal Rescue Fund of MS, that's Mississippi, a nonprofit no-kill animal sanctuary. Schwartzauer then moved to North Carolina, bringing with him a passion for supporting animals and a desire to contribute to that work. All that was missing, apparently, was the beer. Dingo Dog Brewing Company's motto is, saving lives one pint at a time. It's a cutesy tagline, but the small team at Dingo Dog takes it to heart. With each can and keg of beer sold, Schwarzhauer was able to build funds to establish the real thrust of the brewing operation, Dingo Dog Charitable Trust, a 501c3. He explains, everything after our operating cost gets funneled into the nonprofit. The foundation was established to set aside grant money for various local animal groups. Current partners include Beyond Fences, Paws Forever, Carolina Adopt-A-Bulls, and Animal Park. And Schwarzhauer and his team are brewing unique, experimental beers with ingredients grown on the farm or foraged nearby. Plenty of breweries around the country are doing the same, though. What's novel about Dingo Dog is the space they've carved for themselves. Schwarzhauer has bucked the trends by fully embracing the small, local, charity brewery model. Opening the taproom in Carrboro was about as big of an expansion for Dingo Dog as we can expect for quite some time. Schwarzhauer is hoping to build up the brew house so they can increase production, but for now, that's it. They're keeping things small. And he says, we really just want to be producing enough to sell out of the taproom. We've become the neighborhood bar. There are people who come by, grab a beer while they're walking their dog, and keep going. Schwarzhauer is not looking to build a craft beer empire. He just wants to serve his community and maybe save a few lives along the way. And he says, the entire purpose is a moral imperative for me, based on my experience in animal rescue. The beer is kind of secondary for us. And let's continue with brewery news. And this is written by Grace Abels about Full Stream, the brewery in Durham. Smarty Pints. The air stirs as the game is about to begin, possibly from the giant ceiling fan or maybe from all the brain waves filling the bar. The best and brightest of Durham have gathered and are preparing for cerebral combat. The screen flashes to life. Full Stream Brewery presents the 499th edition of Thursday Night Trivia. Very soon, teams will be huddled in heated discussions over a vital fact. Which color M&M is said to act as an aphrodisiac? Full Stream Trivia Night is a quirky Durham tradition that's been puzzling residents for the past 10 years. Every Thursday night, locals, dookies, and high-rise dwelling millennials gather to show their trivia chops and have a pint of the local brew. Try their summer specialty, above-ground pool. Approaching its 500th edition on July 29, Full Stream's weekly trivia night has garnered such a local following because, let's face it, Durham is a city of nerds. Add up, and this group likes to do math, Duke University, Research Triangle Park, and Google, not to mention Apple on the horizon, and the abundance of brainiacs makes Durham a place where it's cool to be smart. We take pride in knowing which Civil War officer is mistakenly credited with inventing baseball, or being able to identify various types of beans. Facts and a good IPA make for a perfect night out. Full Stream, a Durham institution since 2010, serves as the location for this meeting of gray matter. It fits with founder and CEO Sean Lilly Wilson's vision of serving as a community center and mirror of Durham. Teams such as the Quarantinas and Hookers for Jesus sit at orange picnic tables to go head-to-head in the cavernous and partially air-conditioned warehouse. Despite the towering brick walls, the houseplants and skylights keep the brewery welcoming and bright. Odd team names are an essential part of the experience. Some, like Arturo's Bat Goats, named after host Arturo Sanchez, are regulars with team t-shirts, while others dig deep for their inner comic week after week. Other recent names include Nerd Immunity, Trivia Newton John, Botany is Bitchin', and Tequila Mockingbird. The collective brain power of the crowd is impressive. Many participants are Duke grad students, such as the members of Fran's Spicy Meatballs. The rest are young professionals and a few longtime Durhamites. The game is so alluring that some Full Stream employees stay after their shift to play. Tonight, Host Zach Norris rattles off the rules and announces the first category, National Flags Made Out of Food. Snarky categories are part of the fun, such as Canadians, funky body parts, famous elves, words that go with duck, things that spin, and the supermarket as seen by your dog, blurry groceries. As the questions begin to roll out, Sanchez says it's like watching a ripple go through the crowd. When you ask the question, it gets quiet. You see heads come together at the table. It's almost like communion. Immediately, there's a chorus of hurried whispers and nods of agreement. Sometimes after a momentary freeze, faces light up. At one table, players celebrate their guesses, prematurely sure of their correct answer. At another, hands fly, gesturing to argue their side in a fierce debate. For the really hard questions, an audible, huh, can be heard in the sea of blank faces. Then the big question of the moment. What's the most recognized smell in the world? Teams whisper their guesses. Gasoline. Chocolate? Fish? Beer? Players take yet another desperate sip to find the answer hidden somewhere in the foam. Once all 10 questions in a category are asked, teams submit their answers on paper or through their phones. Occasionally, teams will leave messages or doodles for the host as well. The questions change every week. But this trivia night is much like the 498 that have come before. It began in 2011, when Norris approached Fullstream about a weekly event. In 2019, Sanchez joined as an alternating host. During the pandemic, he started virtual trivia, quote, because it gave me that sense of continuity, that sense of normalcy that people were craving so much. Sanchez enjoys being the center of attention and fills his trivia nights with jokes and personal stories. He'll never reuse a question, but there are some noticeable themes. Watch out for celebrities he thinks are cute. Anything related to queer culture, U.S. politics, and the Golden Girls. Norris, on the other hand, is a straightforward, no-frills kind of host, Sanchez said. All answers are submitted on paper, and while it takes him some time to tally the answers by hand, Norris likes this break. He says, I think sometimes a question might spark a memory for somebody, and they'll end up telling their table a story. Norris enjoys the research to put a game together, but unlike his counterpart, I actually don't like getting up in front of people. He focuses on keeping the game moving and creating a pleasant, mind-expanding evening. When it's finally time to announce the answers, the bar becomes quiet. Sonic and the Hedgehog team member Olivier Boivin, a Duke genetics PhD student, sums up the drama. It's been a real roller coaster of emotion, he says. Finally, Norris gets to the tricky one. According to a study by Yale University, what's the most recognized smell in the world? Coffee. Cheers erupt, to picnic tables rock as a few competitors leap out of their seats for a high five to celebrate a surprise correct answer. When the game is done, eyes scan the Excel spreadsheet to see how they have fared. The winner of the night is Zach Zealots. Team member Matt Lowing is a trivia pro who's been playing at various spots in Durham for the past 10 years. He finished the night with a perfect game. Well, now as we reach the close of our broadcast, there's time just to excerpt two articles. One is a very interesting one, applies to I guess it's on YouTube. I'll find out. But it's about Adam Dipert, D-I-P-E-R-T. He spends his time as a nuclear physicist and a circus artist. His next frontier, space juggling. It's written by Brian Woods, this column, and I'll just excerpt a bit of it. A porthole ringed with ghostly LEDs looks out into the darkness of deep space. Just beyond it lies the future, or more specifically, a future form of entertainment, and perhaps even a future art form. In the void, Adam Dipert slowly spins, a trim, bald young man in a high-tech black flight suit with blue piping. In front of him, four white balls float, suspended in mid-space. As the camera spins with Dipert, the stars go whizzing by behind him. and the spheres careen in orbits that it seem at first eccentric before an eerie symmetry manifests. All the while, the revolving man deftly keeps the globes in motion and in check through a series of gentle corrections with his hands. Then the camera stops. When it does, we notice something that should not be. In this perspective, the same balls in the same patterns now are moving in triangular and polygonal patterns in straight lines across the visual field as we'd expect in zero gravity. Then the camera spins again, and the same orbs in the same mobile matrix start curving, arcing, and spiraling once more. Welcome to the world of space juggling. And if one goes, I must stop this article now, to thespacejuggler.com through August 8th, you can see some videos, full-length videos, documenting this new creation over the last 2 weeks. The videos will be available for viewing there at the International Jugglers Association Festival, where he took home first place in the juggling championship competition. And they will be available through August the 8th. And the only other feature I was unable to get to is half and half text and photojournalism. And it documents North Carolina's and the nation's fallen Confederate monuments. Melissa Little wrote the text for this, and the photographs are from very many different photographers, including Raleigh Confederacy Monument and other ones in the state of North Carolina, but around the nation too, with a text talking about the background of their existence and more often than not now, their unexistence or their removal from public life. It's called Where They Stood. So thanks again to Frank for producing music today and now. John Federson has just enough time to direct anyone who wishes to rehear this edition of Indie Week to our ncreadingservice.org website, and you can find years of issues of The Independent. And we hope that you'll be with us next time to hear our next issue of Indie Week. John Federson saying so long.